Heavenly King, Comforter, the Spirit of Truth, present everywhere and filling all things, the treasury of good and giver of life, come and dwell in us and cleanse us from every impurity and save our souls, gracious one.
I'm a little daunted, I must say, firstly because this has been postponed from the last time. I do apologise to anyone who was affected by that postponement. But also tonight, when I got here, Father Chris was saying thank you for coming, which I always tell him he never needs to thank me because it's actually, I consider it a blessing to come and do all of this stuff, especially on a topic that I love and in a place that I love with people that I love. But he was telling me, well, you're sort of breaking new ground. I said, really? You know, he said, yeah, you know, I like to get speakers, and we moved away from the years of just having priests talking and we had non-priests talking, and it's hard to get women. Really, the only woman that I've been able to have speak has been Mother Callisthenie. And I find that a little daunting to be the next woman speaking after Yerondissa. So I'll ask you all to bear with me, and I'm very blessed to have both Father Chris, my spiritual father, and my spiritual mother here. So I don't know whether that's, I'm taking it as a blessing, but I'm feeling a little nervous. I would like to point out that while I am a psychologist and I do lots of presentations and speaking in psychology, obviously internationally as well, and I'm published in a number of journals, including Social Science and Medicine, the Journal of Psychology and Psychiatry, and the British Journal of Psychology, that I don't consider myself to be here speaking as a psychologist, so I'm not going to use too much psychobabble. I certainly have informed what I'm going to talk to you from some of the literature, because I think it's important that we as Orthodox Christians or as human beings recognise that the things we're talking about in our faith practices are also now being recognised around the world in many, many other areas that are not necessarily by people of our faith or of any faith at all. So I want to point that out. On the other hand, I'm not just talking from the perspective of being an Orthodox Christian, because I do want to demonstrate to you that Orthodoxy exists within a context, and Christianity exists within a context, and it applies to every aspect of our life. So for those of you who would like more technical information, perhaps actual journal references or journal articles, catch me later and I'll certainly give you some of that detail, but I'm not going to, I don't know what the level of understanding is or what people's professional roles are or your educations are, so we're going down the middle. But anyone who wants any of that other stuff, yell, okay? And for the spiritual stuff, I'm going to rely very, very heavily on, obviously, Father Chris and Mother Callisthenie. She thought she was here to do nothing except rest and sell books tonight, but pray for me, yes. Okay, so tonight I'm going to be talking about faith and its impact on mental health. And faith is also variously interchanged in the research to date with spirituality and religion, and there doesn't seem to be a lot of differentiation between those terms, so I'm not going to differentiate largely tonight either. But we won't be focusing on Orthodox Christianity per se, because that doesn't occur in the literature. But at the end, I would ask us as a group to reflect how our Orthodox faith sits within the research and from our own experience to enhance mental health, both for ourselves and for the people around us, because I think we can draw on that sort of knowledge and remind ourselves of how we can use our faith. Interestingly, since the early attitude of Freud, you must have heard of Freud, some people call him a fraud, but anyway, Freud, he largely reduced the whole notion of religion or religiosity or faith to the context of being a problematic behaviour, potentially a problem, or and an unreal or a psychotic belief. So there really at that time was no place in psychology for addressing issues of spirituality, and a lot of people felt that they ran the risk, and indeed I hear now that a lot of people feel they run the risk of being labelled nuts if they talk about their faith and about spirituality. However, there has been a dramatic turnaround in the last 15, 20 years, so much so that the Australian Psychological Society now have various colleges and interest groups within its body, and the Royal College of Psychiatrists and the American Psychological Association, like many other professional bodies around the world, now provide guidelines to clinicians, that's to psychologists, registered practicing psychologists, about the importance and the effectiveness of incorporating issues of religion and spirituality, so faith, into clinical assessment and to treatment plans. Now, that's a huge step, a huge step. In my own practice, I found that really important. Even in the years before I became an Orthodox Christian, I was a Christian, and there were many, many people, I don't know, word of mouth is very powerful, and I remember once, many years ago, a woman ringing me up on the phone and saying she wanted to find out about making an appointment to see me at St Albans, actually. And she said, and I had this conversation with her for about 3-4 minutes on the phone, and then she said, "Are you a Christian?" And I said, "Yes, I am. I don't necessarily superimpose that on our work, but I make no bones about the fact that I'm a Christian." And she said, "No, that's good. I'll come and see you then." I thought, goodness, it's the first time that's happened. And when she came into my office, she said that she'd had the experience of wanting to talk about her Christianity and about her problems with her faith. People often talk about their challenges in faith, or they talk about how they use their faith to process their life. And she found that that was shut down by other counsellors a lot. It was shut down. They didn't want to know, or they brushed it off, or they scoffed at it, or they seemed to attach themselves to it like it was a problem that needed to be dealt with. And I've seen increasingly that's an issue. Interestingly, because I work in a multicultural area, although I think all of Melbourne is multicultural these days, I see a lot of people of a lot of different faiths, Judaism, Islam, all the different areas of Christianity, and of course I see a lot of Orthodox people too. And it's interesting that from all of those denominations, all of those perspectives, that even though I make no bones about my faith, they walk into my clinic and they see icons and crosses and things like that. Most of them either comment positively or don't comment at all. You might want to know a story that I'm always touched by, is that one Christmas, I always put out a nativity set in my waiting room, and one Christmas we found one of the staff came in to me and said, "I think you'd better come out to the waiting room." And I thought, oh, here we go. And I went out there, and there was this man standing in front of the nativity set venerating Jesus. And there was another man had come in later that day and had said, "What's this? You know, I don't celebrate Christmas. You shouldn't have this here." And the gentleman who had been venerating Jesus, a Muslim man, said, "We respect Jesus. Don't be so rude." And so I've never had any problem about it at all. I have a lot of people of the Muslim faith come to me, along with other faiths. And so I think if we're honest in our faith with ourselves and with the rest of the world, it's never going to be a problem. And I think that's partly what contributes to good mental health, is being honest, having integrity, and knowing where you're at. So that's what I think. Anyway, so lots of that goes on in my practice. So when I'm doing assessments, I often will say to people, do you have a faith that helps you in your time of crisis? Do you have a relationship with a church or a mosque or a synagogue? And most people seem enormously relieved to be allowed to say something about that, because it's not very common apparently. And I do hear lots of, I'm loath to admit it, horror stories of people who have seen other counsellors or other psychologists, and that's been really shut down. So I like to bring it into my work and my assessment and refer people back. The beauty of being Orthodox and seeing some Orthodox people is that I can often say to them, "I really think you should discuss this with your spiritual father. Have you thought about speaking to your spiritual father? Have you taken this to confession?" And it's really useful. And I know I'm very blessed that sometimes the fathers do the same thing. They'll say, "This really isn't a spiritual issue. Go and see a psychologist." So that's very comforting. So I want to tell you a little bit about the way these professional bodies around the world are now starting to say to practitioners, look at faith, look at spirituality, look at those dimensions and religiosity and religion. So the Royal College of Psychiatrists, that's the British Royal College of Psychiatrists, see spirituality as something everyone can experience. They see it as helping people to find meaning and purpose in the things we value, and as bringing hope in times of suffering and loss, and as encouraging us to seek our best relationship with ourselves, others, and what lies beyond. So that sounds like it's fairly universal, and I'm really pleased that these professional bodies are now recognising the importance of that aspect of humanity. And it notes that spirituality often becomes important in times of distress, emotional stress, physical and mental illness, loss, bereavement, and the approach of death, and that spirituality is a part of good health care, and that it emphasizes the healing of the person, not just the disease. So this applies in physical health as well as in mental health. So we don't look at someone as having schizophrenia or as having lupus or having cancer, and we do, because they are a person who has cancer like a person who has diabetes. We don't refer to them in psychology, and we try, and I'm actually a supervisor and a trainer of psychologists as well, and I emphasise that we need to deal with people as one whole person. So if we're dealing with people as one whole person, we can't leave out the bit that says spirituality or faith or religion, can we? So we need to bring that in, and that's what we're trying to encourage in the profession. And it also notes, this is the British Association of Psychiatry, notes that it views life as a journey. So spirituality views life as a journey where good and bad experiences can help you learn, develop and mature. And it's interesting that if we think about it, without spirituality of some sort, without looking at that aspect of ourselves, that we really often run the risk that we don't learn from our experiences, good or bad, and we don't develop and mature. And when I was a university lecturer and coordinator, that one of the things that shocked students in psychology a lot was that as adults we have developmental stages. Most of us know that children have developmental stages and milestones. We do as adults as well. I won't go into all of that. If you want that, I'll send it to you. But interestingly, many people never attain the higher two levels of moral development, which are the later stages of development. And this often comes about, I believe, because they haven't addressed their spirituality or faith issues. That doesn't mean they have to become Orthodox Christians like I chose to, but they do have to address that side of themselves. Otherwise, they have a hole in their personality, a hole in their wholeness, in their being. So we're recognising that and training that. And a lot of students in psychology are shocked to realise that without that sort of thing, many, many people walking around the street, we're talking 60-year-olds, 70-year-olds, have never reached their full developmental stages and never will. A lot of people never do, which is rather sad, because if we see a child not reaching their developmental milestones, what do? We go into action and we try and do something about it and say, why hasn't this child walked by the age of two? All that sort of stuff. It's the same as an adult, and that's just starting to be recognised now. Now, the same society, the British Society of Psychiatry, after examining some survey data, and again, all of this stuff I can give you if you like, they note that incorporating issues of spirituality in assessment and treatment resulted in service users having better self-control and self-esteem and confidence, faster and easier recovery, often through healthy grieving of losses and through recognising their own strengths, better relationships with themselves, others, and with God or creation or nature, however they wanted to typify that. And they have a new sense of meaning, hope and peace of mind, and that this has allowed them to accept and to live with continuing problems. So I'm not saying it solves all the problems, but it gives you a way of coping with those problems, and that's really important. And that survey data also noted that spiritual practices can include belonging to a faith tradition and taking part in services or other activities with other people, to take part in rituals, symbolic practices and other forms of worship, to go on pilgrimages or retreats, spending time enjoying nature, to give of yourself in acts of compassion, so to go outside of yourself and to give, you know, especially if you're working in a team. This was one of those practices that was identified in the survey as being really positive. To spend time in meditation, deep reflection or prayer, or to read scripture, to listen to singing or playing sacred music, songs, hymns, psalms and devotional chants, to spend time in contemplative reading, to appreciate the arts, to be creative, painting, sculpture, cookery, gardening. All of these things are seen as part of the spiritual process. And we know from our own faith that we can think how we do that, how are we guided to do that within our faith. It also meant the making and keeping of good family relationships, that they were able to make and keep good friendships, especially those with trust and intimacy, things that are often very difficult for people who haven't explored their faith and have a faith to guide them. And they can join in team sports and activities, again, activities that involve cooperation and trust. So spiritual practices then help us to develop the better part of ourselves and thereby to become more creative, patient, persistent, honest, kind, compassionate, wise, calm, hopeful, and joyful. These are all part of the best forms of healthcare and mental healthcare. The American Psychological Association affirmed that people often turn to their faith as a source of solace and support in their most stressful times, and the empirical studies of many groups dealing with major life stresses such as natural disasters, illness, loss of loved ones, divorce and serious mental illness show that religion and spirituality are generally helpful to people in coping. So again and again, this notion of spirituality and faith being important to people is creeping into the scientific literature. That's really important. And that people can draw from many religious and spiritual resources that have been tied to better adjustment in times of crisis. These positive religious coping methods include spiritual support from God or a higher power, rituals to facilitate transitions, the notion of spiritual forgiveness, support from a religious institution or clergy, and reframing a stressful situation into a larger, more benevolent system of meaning. So we're able to see the good, the silver lining in the cloud, if you like. Moreover, research that's continuing now shows that treating these processes in a secular way, so that means treating these processes as if there wasn't an element of spirituality or faith, does not yield the same protective impact. I'm going to say that again. If you treat these processes in a secular way, that does not yield the same protective impact, and suggests that something may be lost when these constructs are disconnected from their larger context of faith. For example, research has shown that mantra-based meditation, you know, people going om or saying the name of their great uncle or whatever it is, or I will survive, something like that, that mantra-based meditation compared to spiritual phrase, which is more effective. So if you're saying a spiritual phrase, it's more effective in reducing even physical pain than meditation in a secular phrase. Okay, so all of these people say, I mean, make a positive affirmation, you know, I will survive, I will be strong today. It does have some benefit, no doubt about it. But the same sort of process engaging a spiritual phrase is shown to significantly enhance someone's coping, particularly with pain. That's what the most research has been on at the moment. That's not to say it doesn't enhance other things. So, for example, I often incorporate something like that. I must admit, more often with people of the Orthodox faith when I'm working with them, because we have the ideal shortened phrase to use. What do you think it would be? Absolutely. Absolutely. And so it's really exciting that here it is at our fingertips. Now, other studies have shown that spiritual forms of support and meaning, making and coping, predict health and well-being beyond the effects of secular support, meaning, making and coping. So if we make some sort of meaning out of a disaster based on a secular idea and we don't include the notion of faith or spirituality or reference to those things, then we don't cope as well. And we don't make as successful a meaning of a disaster, and therefore we don't cope as well. So thus it appears that religion and spirituality cannot be fully reduced or explained by other psychological or social processes. So, for example, belonging to a religious congregation is not equivalent to belonging to a Rotary or a Lions Club. They might do the same things at some times, but in terms of coping and mental health and well-being, they do not have the same effect. They have a positive effect, but it is not the same as those that are in the spiritual or faithful context. And I think that's really fascinating. And it's more fascinating that, yes, it's published in the scientific literature, not in our Bible studies group, not in our church newsletter, not in a book on faith, but in a scientific journal. I'm not saying a scientific journal is better, but I am saying by getting that sort of stuff into a scientific journal enhances more acceptance by practitioners and encourages practitioners to learn to do it and to acknowledge the importance of it. And I think that's brilliant. So what is the difference between that secular and the faithful component. So religion and spirituality have a focus on the sacred elements, on transcendence, on ultimate truth, not just the truth today, but on ultimate truth, on infinitude, so it's long-lasting, and on deep connectedness. And from my experience, and I have no research to back this up, but from my experience working with people, I think it's that deep connectedness that is so enhancing of good mental health. And in fact, some research I did myself, I've done a lot of research on chronic illness, and a lot of that research showed that people who had a faith base and had, through that, had a deep connectedness with significant others, we could actually change the physical outcome of some diseases. The diseases that I've done that with in my research and in my work, some years ago, I might add, have been initially in HIV, where we've been able to increase T cell counts. Now think about that. The mind-body connection through the application of connectedness with a faith-based belief and understanding of the situation can improve the physical outcomes, the physical course of a disease. We've shown that in HIV. I've shown that in HIV, in stroke, diabetes, arthritis, and multiple sclerosis. And I think that's very, very important work. Now, I'm not saying that all of you are ever going to face those sorts of things, some serious mental health illness or a serious physical illness, but it does demonstrate to us that by having a faith base, by thinking about our faith base and acknowledging it on a daily basis, that we can enhance our well-being, both physical and mental. So it's easy to get caught up in the world out there and to forget about that stuff, just the simple stuff. I'll share with you, in fact, that when Father Chris was talking to me when I first got here tonight, I said to him, don't thank me, because I was having a lousy weekend and I had planned to prepare this speech on Sunday, and come Sunday morning I really didn't think I was going to do it. And I was thinking, oh, I don't think I'll go to work on Monday either, but although I had a list of 10 clients to see today. But I went outside, did my little walk, lit my gandili, sensed the house. Somehow my path headed back into the office and I sat down at my desk and I started to write up what I was going to do for you tonight. And in doing that, that reminded me of the power of my faith base. And that reminded me of the joy and the power that we all have in our faith base. And that's why I'm able to share that with my clients and with the graduating clinicians that I supervise and with students that I teach at university when I do. I'm only a guest lecturer there now. Thank God I'm out of academia. So there's been a lot of research and a lot of review of research, and I want to talk a little bit more about that so that you know there's some articles that have been published in the International Journal of Applied Psychoanalytic Studies, for example. Levin did a lot of research and reviewed a lot of research. And these studies explore the impact of religious indicators on psychiatric and mental health outcomes in population, community, hospital samples, and the rates of mood disorders such as depression and anxiety, levels of psychological distress using a number of various assessment instruments. By that we mean pen and paper things. Dimensions of psychological well-being, where we use scales to measure how someone is doing psychologically. Life satisfaction, happiness, patterns of self-destructive behaviour, an interesting inverse correlation, including the addictions and mental health care utilisation. So the weight of evidence on average and across these studies suggests that religion, however it's assessed, is generally a protective factor for mental illness per se. Full stop. No qualification on that. It just is. Again, something that's being recognised over and over again. Now, I can share this Levin article with you if you like. If we go back to the 1940s, right up to today, there have been dozens and dozens of researchers who have looked at spirituality, and they're trying to operationalise what spirituality means, what religion means, what faith means, and all those sorts of things. And they think that the subject of spirituality, broadly constructed, is related to the quest for human potential and flourishing. So what does that tell us, even in that description, in that definition that these scientists are looking for, that these clinicians are looking for? They are also still saying that the construct of spirituality and faith relates to human potential and flourishing, not to its demise, not to its lower echelons, but to something positive and getting better. And so overall, there was an authoritative view by Koenig in 1998, so it's not that long ago. Well, not for me, it's not anyway, that mental health influences of religious beliefs and practices, particularly when those religious beliefs and practices are embedded within a long-standing, well-integrated faith tradition, is largely a positive one. So more and more and more research about those sorts of things. And that most studies focus on dimensions of well-being, life satisfaction, congruence, happiness, positive affect, depressed mood, constructs for which we already had really valid ways of measuring, and then we looked at the preventative role of faith in clinical depression and anxiety disorders and to some addictive behaviours. And the findings were still very positive, indicative of a generally salutary effect of religious identity or religious practice. And in a handbook of religion and health, again by Koenig in 2001, he summarised hundreds of studies, hundreds, analysing the effects of dimensions of religion on depression, suicide, anxiety disorders, schizophrenia even and other psychoses, alcohol and drug use, delinquency, features of personality and other outcomes. And the weight of evidence was positive. Over half of the studies in these categories point to a statistically significant protective effect of faith. We're not just talking about someone feels better, but to appease the scientists, if there are some in the audience, and to people who are studying these things, it was statistically significant, replicatable, consistent. That's very important. And studies of dimensions of psychological distress and well-being consistently find that protective effect in religious participation. And that features institutional religious involvement, you know, that's attendance at worship services, and non-institutional involvement, private prayer, embeddedness in religious support networks, and mental health outcomes and high scores on scales and indices assessing psychosocial constructs by psychosocial mean how someone feels in the context of where they live. So their personal relationships, their interpersonal relationships, their work, their play, everything. And so we had really positive effects on measures of self-esteem, mastery, so the idea that they had, they were self-efficacious, optimism, hope, and the dimensions of well-being. This overall finding has been replicated across all the age cohorts in both sexes, regardless of social class, race, ethnicity, religious affiliation, and specific diagnosis or outcome measure. So it didn't matter how it was examined, that positivity of effect was found. And many studies have found a health-promoting effect of religion on overall and on domain-specific. So by domain-specific, we mean that if we look at a particular aspect on depression or whatever, life satisfaction, happiness and positive affect. And positive affect, by the way, it means good mood. Okay. So to summarise, religious involvement, broadly defined, exhibits a salutary and primary preventative function in relation to psychological distress and outcomes related to mental health and well-being. These findings are consistent, and a protective effect of religiousness seems to be especially salient. When examining population rates of morbidity, there is a modest advantage on average attributable to religious practice as well. I thought you'd like to know that as well. So there is actually a lifelong enhancement. So we live a bit longer if we practice religion. I'm going to skip some of this for you. So some theoretical perspectives about why that works. Why does faith do this for us? Why does spirituality do this for us? And so the religious impulse is seen to be expressed through lots of different ways, different behaviours, emotions, motivations, beliefs, attitudes, thoughts, values, experiences, relationships. And independently of religion, before we even started to look at religion or faith, we've long known that our behaviours, emotions and social relationships are significant health determinants, both in mental health and physical health. You've all heard of some of those stories, haven't you? Okay. But now we're applying the faith dimension to it. And commitment to a religious belief system may well benefit health by promoting healthy behaviours conducive to wellness. So this is if we look at it from a behavioural perspective. What does faith tell you to do that looks after you? All right? So that commitment to your religious belief, that commitment to your faith and that system of religious belief gets you to do things that look after you and promote wellness. So that might be avoidance of tobacco, alcohol, drugs, antisocial behaviours. And fellowship with like-minded people embeds you in a formal and an informal social network that facilitates that you receive tangible and emotional support and reflected appraisal for doing those things. So private or group prayer or worship may produce salutary emotions, gratitude, humility, grace, forgiveness, love. And these all have a preventative and a therapeutic effect. One of the things I often do with clients who are very negative or very depressed and sometimes, you know, can't even get out of bed and they can't see any good in the world, one of the things I do is get them a little calendar. You know those calendars with little tiny boxes on it? I don't want them to be daunted to think that I want them to write a journal because they're not up to it. So I give them those little calendars with, you know, little 2-centimetre boxes on it. And I ask them to spend a week or whatever it is, perhaps two if they're not too bad, before their next appointment, making a point every day of finding something to be glad about and writing it in that box. Now, some people need to be asked to do that exercise more than once before they're able to do it, and I guide them. And just the fact that they are able to find something to be glad about, some positive thing in the day. I often say to them, it might be the worst day on earth, but by God, you enjoyed that cup of coffee you had this morning. Or the little girl that walked past your gate smiled at you. Some little thing. Or you saw the wind blow a flower. Or it rained, and that was a good thing. Or it didn't rain, and that was a good thing. But acknowledge something to be glad for. Now, you think about it. If you have a faith base, that's part of what we do anyway, isn't it? So you don't need someone like me telling you to go out and look for something to be glad about, because you've got it at your fingertips. I think that's really powerful. And religious beliefs about God, about human existence, the purpose of life, life after death, free will, you know, human obligations, the nature of evil, they might be consonant beliefs that foster preventive healthcare practices. So they get you to do the good stuff. Faith or religious certainty might engender positive expectations that instill hope and optimism, capable of preventing or ameliorating distress. In sum, psychological mediation of a religion-mental health link is plausible and consistent with research on every level. And in fact, if we look at that just from that behavioural perspective, we have something called a BDI, which is a well-established, very short measure of depression. And one of the key indicators on there of serious levels of depression is hopelessness. So if you have a faith base that gives you something to be hopeful with, that guides you how to be hopeful, helps you see things in context, then you've ticked off a big likelihood that you're going to suffer from depression. So bear that in mind. We have it at our fingertips. Now we can also look at a biological explanation for why faith helps us, and that can be that positivity of mental attitude. And if you Google me, you'll find some research about attitude in multiple sclerosis. And positivity of attitude, which is enhanced by a faith base, and that came through when I was doing the initial stage of that research too. Faith base was very important. But it also showed that you actually have a biochemical effect in your body. You don't have to do anything except have faith. And you have positive biochemical outputs. It's pretty nifty when you understand the mind-body interchange and you can learn how to do that. Then we had a look at the psychodynamic explanations, where the tendency of religious belief to give rise to psychodynamics engendering greater peacefulness, self-confidence and a sense of purpose were very positive. And these outcomes can be symbiotic or go hand in hand with certain personality styles or with theological perspectives such as Calvinism. So what we found in the research, when I was reviewing this to come and talk to you, and I actually spoke to Father Chris about it a few weeks ago, is that there has been a distinction. Although there's not a big distinction made about Orthodox Christians versus Methodists versus Jews, etc., 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 there has been a distinction made in more than one piece of research that where your faith base centres around religious practices and understandings that centre on the idea of God as being benevolent, loving, giving, nurturing, and we have those listed in our faith-based practices, then we have positive mental health outcomes. Conversely, some things such as Calvinism or some of the other, there are some Christian faiths that are hellfire and brimstone, punitive, have a punitive God, not a loving father, but this punitive notion, you know, it's almost evil, it's almost demonic, isn't it? You know, be good or else, not be good because you love being good. That has a really negative impact on mental health outcomes. So there is that distinction that's come through. And then we look at the transpersonal explanations where we refer to states beyond the personal and the egoistic. And it's oriented toward development of human potential, and that includes attributes and functions of higher consciousness. That's what I was talking about before, you know, moral development, higher consciousness. Transpersonal therapy emphasises self-determination, self-actualisation, self-realisation and self-transcendence. And the significance here is found in the psychophysiological correlates of transcendence and markers of other transpersonal experiences. Health and mood-related sequelae are spiritually motivated pursuits. So the health and the physical stuff, especially that biochemical stuff I was talking to you about, that comes about when you're doing something that's motivated on a spiritual basis, engenders a potentially therapeutic process. And they're things like meditation and prayer, okay? And so to conclude on that level, the empirical evidence supports a generally protective effect of religious involvement for mental illness and psychological distress, and that this evidence that for the positivity of faith in being preventative of mental health and in being supportive of those with mental health in a positive way are statistically significant, replicatable, and clear in their magnitude. And so let's look briefly, and I'm going to ask you to think about this, what I asked you when I first got up here. Think about what you know about your faith, what you know from your experience. And I'd implore you when we finish in a minute to discuss the aspects of orthodoxy that contribute to good mental health. Just briefly, these might be that we have guidelines for relationships and behaviour, relationships with each other, relationships with others, relationships with God. So we have those guidelines for relationships and behaviour. We have a belief in a loving, forgiving Father in God, don't we? We have participation in meaningful rituals and practices. We have guidelines for eating. We have the tonal quality of chants. And they've actually done research. They've hooked up people's brains and they've put them in CT scanners and seen what the effect on the body is when they're listening to those things, and it's very positive. We have the grounding meditative effects of the Jesus Prayer at our fingertips. We have support from the clergy. We have support from other like-minded people. So here you are, you're all here listening to me. You come to church or to another church. If you say to the person next to you, I was over at, you know, St. George's the other day and I thought it was fabulous. The priest was saying X, Y, Z. They're not going to turn to you and say, are you weird or what? They're going to say, really? So you're getting positive reflected appraisal, which is really important for feeling good about yourself, for being psychologically well and sound, is this positive reflected appraisal. So you get it reflected back. You don't have to think you're good. The people around you show you that you're good. And that it's okay. And you get that because they don't look at you like you're weird. So you're in a community that supports you and you're getting that reflected back. And the opportunity for that reflected appraisal to be positive is enhanced because you're within a group that has similar values. And importantly, we also have the opportunity for confession. That's very powerful. Often I find people who don't have a faith base and those who do, when they come into my office and they see me as a clinical psychologist, they're not coming there for any other reason, that it's almost confessional. And indeed, sometimes I actually say, really, you should be telling your priest this. But they try it out on me. And people who don't have a faith base at all use it as a confessional. It is very cathartic. It is good for your mental health to own and acknowledge what you've done, the good and the bad. And so we have that already built into our faith base here. I think that's really brilliant. And so I don't want to bore you. I don't want to bash you over the head with it because I get pretty excited by this stuff. I know, I'm a Fruit Loop. I'm one of those people who was first appalled at myself when I realised one of my pieces of research, I was sitting in the old days, it used to take a long time for stats to chug through a computer, and I was sitting in the back office at my home, and I was waiting for the statistics to chug through the computer, and when they came up on the screen, I went, yes! And I thought, oh my God, you're pathetic. So I don't expect you to have that same sort of excitement over this stuff, but please think about that, because if you think about what faith does for your mental health, you can share that with the people around you, with your kids, with your family. You don't even have to tell them that's what you're doing. You just do it. And then you feel better, they feel better. If you go through a crisis, you cope with it better. You have some tools at your fingertips to deal with crises. If you're feeling miserable, you have a way to get out of it. It's all positive. So what I'd like to ask you, I know you might have some questions, but I think I'd rather see some discussion going on. If people could share some of their experiences, some of their ideas about this stuff, I'm sure a lot of you have a lot of experience that you could share with us. Would anyone like to?
Thanks for a wonderful talk. I just wanted to say I listen to a lot of different clinical cases, and one thing that I have found, you know, whether it's, you know, distress and they don't have meaningful or long-lasting relationships, and there's a lot of more alcohol than drugs, and there's a lot of meaninglessness and hopelessness. And it struck me after, well, I've been listening to it for years, that they don't have a faith base at all, these people. That's right. And sometimes their family, or usually, I'm not sure, I don't have statistics, but I've been listening to this for years. And the family where they came from didn't have that nurturing in a traditional faith either. Mm. And the other thing I was wondering if you could say, because this is the other thing I've noticed, the relationships and the sexuality, the casual relationships, the casual sex. Mm. And, you know, a lot of people say, oh, it's just like eating or parking your car or what have you. But it isn't.
No.
Because you can see the effect on these people who are without faith, and that they're devastated.
Absolutely.
And they're lonely, and they have no self-esteem, and it's so tragic.
It is.
And that's what you see in secular society a lot of the time. And, well, I just wondered what your impressions
were. I absolutely concur, and I think that that's a really important issue. And I don't know whether any of you have attended or know about the fact that over the last little while, perhaps not so little now, Father Chris and I have actually incorporated some of that into the catechism classes. And it's really, really important that within that context we're able to draw on psychology and on faith and religious practices and the doctrine of the church to guide people in that, not only in their sexuality but in their sexual expression within marriage, and getting them to come to terms with what they may or may not have done before marriage. And that's very important, because those sorts of behaviours are both health preventative, organic health and mental health preventative, but also potentially destructive if they're not on the right path. So I think that's really, really important. And again, I point out to you, as you all know, I'm preaching to the converted here, aren't I? But we have that. We have these guidelines. If we live our faith, even if we stray away from our faith, we can say, oh, hang on a minute, I'll come back to that. And it heals you. It's very healing.
Thank you for your talk tonight. I mean, there's so many questions that I want to ask, so I think I'll make an appointment with you.
Okay.
No, but there's a distinction you said between what is spiritual and what is psychological. And I find that sometimes our priests don't make that clarification very clear to us. So that's my first question to you. Mm-hmm. My second question is, we have all these things, the Jesus prayer and prayer and a guideline on how to live our lives, yet everyone around me, including myself, we seem to be depressed. We seem to be moping around. Is this a spiritual attack? And what does clinical psychologists think of spiritual attacks? And do they go hand in hand? I mean, a person with schizophrenia, is this a physical thing, or is it a spiritual attack, or is it both? And sorry for all the questions.
No, that's
there.
All right.
Like I said, I've got many questions.
Now, what was the first question?
The first question was how
spirituality versus psychology.
Yeah.
I actually don't think it's necessarily a distinction. I think in a lot of cases there is a clear distinction, but not necessarily so, because the two are not interchangeable, they're intertwined. You can have a spiritual problem that causes you to have a psychological problem, or vice versa. And so I've been very fortunate, and it's not just Father Chris, I'm blessed to say, over the years, there is a growing awareness among psychologists, as I pointed out to you, about the importance of spirituality. But there is also a growing awareness among our priests, and I can only speak about Orthodox priests because I don't have the same relationships with all the other churches, although I do a couple of other churches, that not everything is spiritual. And in fact, some priests have said to me, sometimes people come and they want to say, oh, this is a spiritual problem. And they say, no, it's not. It's a psychological problem. Go and see a shrink. Or they say, no, it's not. You're just avoiding responsibility by saying, oh, this is God, or this is a demonic attack. It might be, but the call for that comes from your priest, I think. And I hear what you're saying, that priests aren't always good at explaining the distinction, but I think that is changing. And I'm very, very pleased to, I can tell you absolutely that I've seen evidence of that change within our own clergy, within the Orthodox Church. I think it's very, very positive. And I think it's very good for all of us. And I think it's very respectful of the church, and it's very respectful of us as human beings practicing Christianity. I think it's very good. So please don't think that they're not trying to do that. They do. And there are many priests who will say to someone, you know what? Don't blame this on God. This is not a spiritual issue. Go sort yourself out.
Actually, I'd like to add to or continue on from what your question is. Kaylin's talk was excellent, but I find a lot of people have a difficulty is we have that faith, we believe that God exists, but at those difficult times, we're not in the good habit of practicing our faith.
Yes.
I find a lot of people, like all the others, all the grannies, are used to praying. Mm. They will say their morning prayers, their evening prayers. They'll go to church. They will fast every Wednesday and Friday. They'll go to church feast days. They actually practice their faith exactly as the church gives it. So it's not those weak times of saying, yes, I've got a faith, but I don't know what to do. Mm. Or I find a lot of people go through a lot of mental turmoil themselves when they have some sort of crisis, is they've got the faith, but they feel as if they're falling short of how to use their faith. In other words, I don't know how to pray. Mm. Or a lot of the times as well is, I was discussing with Kaylin before, is our faith isn't just believing a God exists somewhere. It's actually how I can actually feel God's presence with me every minute of the day. Mm. That living our presence of God. And a lot of the times we need to actually focus on cultivating virtues and getting rid of our passions. If I'm churning myself up with guilt, anger, blaming everybody else, and never looking at myself, so self-blame and self-examination, not in a depressing way, but in how I can improve myself, only through God's strength, sorry, then it actually can help us lift our psychological state.
Absolutely.
Whereas a lot of people get despaired because they think, I've got faith, but it's not helping me.
Mm.
Yes, but that's where
they don't engage in the
fathers,
practices.
Our youth groups, the monastery, we can help you. Okay. Like we had just the other day, some people came to the monastery, and at the same time, our builders called us onto the building site, something to do. And I knew this couple of people needed to learn to say the Paraklesi. I said to the sister, give them the book, throw them in the church, and tell them they can read the prayer. And they came out, they said, oh, we really enjoyed doing that. I said, you can do it every day.
That's right.
So sometimes we can be disappointed within ourselves through our own sinfulness that we need to try and avoid sin, or at least acknowledge our sinfulness and repentance and confession. And also to fairly say, I need help to learn.
Mm.
If I'm going to learn how to use an iPhone, it took me ages because I'm not technical. You know, young kids who know how to do those are quicker and easier.
Yeah.
So if we learn to live our faith, then we can actually grow.
Absolutely.
Spiritually.
And engage in our faith practices.
Yeah.
And this is what I was talking
about. If that helped, our lack of living it correctly can be dragging us down.
You've answered that question perfectly. Thank you for that.
That's really important too.
And it is, because I find that when I used to teach theology, when it was, whether it was small children or older people, they believed in Christ, they loved Christ, but they were constantly sad. And they were constantly
I applaud and admire and take advantage and gain succor from Eurondice's kindness. As a clinical psychologist, I'm not always that kind. And that's because I believe that some people talk about having faith, but they don't actually act as if they have faith. They talk about love, but they don't act in a loving fashion. And the same applies for faith. So if you don't engage in your faith practices like Eurondice was talking about, but also if at the end of the day, if you are so totally overwhelmed, either spiritually or psychologically or whatever, if you have faith and you actually have faith and you remind yourself, what is faith? Faith is believing in the face of lack of proof. Faith is giving it up to God because that's all you've got to do. You can't do anything else. So I don't think saying, I have faith, I love God, I love Jesus is enough. You actually have to do it. Yeah. It's a bit like the drowning man who's, you know, kicking upstream and saying, oh, God, help me, God, help me. And God's looking down and he's not even kicking his legs. We've got to kick our legs, you know.
Yeah, sometimes it's just a matter of starting off with that first sentence, reading that first sentence.
Absolutely.
And then before you know it, you've read the whole paragraph.
Absolutely.
But what about the association? Sorry if I'm hogging the microphone here too much, guys. Sorry, but I'm like you. I love this topic. Mm-hmm. What's the association between a person who has depression, who has schizophrenia? You know, our elders, my parents used to say, "Oh, after some person that you know, he's demonic. He's got an evil spirit in him, and things like that." Yeah. And where the reason why I ask is, I find that it goes hand in hand. I think through the sacraments of the church and through talking to somebody like a clinical psychologist, a person can learn to live with these things.
Oh, absolutely. You can learn to live with all of those things, but you can also learn to overcome a lot of those things.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to, if you've been diagnosed with depression, you don't be depressed for the rest of your life.
And that doesn't necessarily mean that you're demonically
attacked. No, absolutely
attacked
not.
Or you
However, and please, Father or Your Honesty might want to talk about this, but from my point of view, I actually do believe that if someone is depressed, and it's not necessarily a demonic attack or anything like that, but it might make them more susceptible to something like that because they lose their faith. Well, they question their faith and they don't engage in their faith practices because the lethargy of depression stops them engaging and getting up and having a wash, let alone doing the other things. Yeah, go on.
Yet on this, I just want to say thank you. That was a good reply. And thank you for your time as well. And sorry for the questions, everyone.
I'm actually just lately I've had a difficulty that a lot of people who phone the monastery or visit the monastery say, please pray for so one, ejito demonio. You know, there's a demon. It's as if they're possessed of a demon.
Mm.
Can I just say, there's a big, big difference between all of us, that ordinary, everyday, today temptations that that the demons will put there for us. There's evil spirits, there's good spirits. That doesn't mean I have the devil possessing my soul. There's a big difference. There are very, very few people who have the demons actually possessing their soul. Unfortunately, some of our priests very easily and too easily read exorcism prayers, and then people actually get scared that the priest read an exorcism prayers, I must be possessed. Whereas that person may be full of their passions and they need a confession.
Yep. And from a psychological point of view, on top of that, is that if they're saying, you know, I'm possessed of a demon, that relegates their responsibility to do anything
There's
about
no
the situation.
To do
it's not a cop-out. Yeah. Having faith is not a cop-out.
Yeah. So sometimes, and also people with mental illness, there's a stigma, which is wrong. It's much easier to say, I've got someone who's tyrannized by schizophrenia undiagnosed.
Yeah.
Because they say, I don't want anyone to put a label of schizophrenia on my sister. And this person is tyrannized. You know, and they're all saying she's got demons and the demons are playing with her mind and this person's talking.
And unfortunately, sometimes when that's rife, it also prevents them or stops them or
from getting
appropriate treatment.
That's
just wicked. I have to say, though, we can't always blame a priest or blame a psychologist. I have had more than one client, one's in my mind at the moment, a lovely Orthodox Christian lady. However, she really battled with what I was asking her to do to alleviate her situation and improve her psychological well-being, and it wasn't palatable. And she wanted to really hold on to the idea that this was demonic possession or something like that. And she went back and back and back to her priest. And she went to another priest and another priest. Fortunately, she finally got to the point where her priest said, I want you to practice obedience. Of course, Father, she said. And he said, well, do everything that Kayleen told you. And I think that showed great intelligence and great insight.
Can I just say there's healing for any mental illness. There's healing for spiritual illness, our passions, and there's also healing from any possession of the devil or any temptations. Yep. So no one should despair. But you need to know what medicines to use or combinations with each.
I just wanted to say we can learn from the ancient Greeks who had a saying, Sinathina ke hiragini, which is, by all means, you know, pray to the deity, but do something to help yourself.
Absolutely.
Too.
Thank you very much. I'm very blessed to be here tonight.
Thank you.
The issue of homosexuality in our community, how is that perceived within the spiritual versus the...
I won't comment on the spiritual aspect. I think that's something you should be asking the priest or your undersir about. But that issue does come to my office. It often does come to my office, and it comes to my office within the Greek Orthodox community as well. And as a practicing psychologist, it's my role, I'm behooved in my role to take on board the issues of the client without him overlaying my own perspectives. And that's sometimes difficult. And so the way I overcome that is I make it clear what my perspective is, but I explain that I will step outside of that if I need to respect your perspective. As a practicing clinician, my belief is that if they've come to my office and they're troubled enough to come to my office and raise that issue, then they're not happy with it. And so we do a whole lot of exploration about how it's come about, whether it's come about, how they feel about it, what they can do about it, and what are some of the options. It's a very, very unique situation because you can't say all homosexuals are the same because they're not. Not all of us are the same, are we? Just because someone has a particular sexual orientation doesn't mean that they have the same cognitions or thoughts about it or feelings about it. But if they present it in my office, it's causing them trouble.
Through the prayers of our holy fathers, Lord Jesus Christ, our God, have mercy on us and save us. Amen. May God bless you all and keep you well.